Hey, GeoTrekkers, welcome to a new episode of the GeoTrek Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Hurricane Hal. Hope you're excited for a new episode here where we're featuring Robert Spetta, a broadcast and operational meteorologist based in Jacksonville, Florida. Robert works with First Coast News in Northeast Florida, but he does a ton of international forecasting for the West PAC. That's right, Western Pacific Ocean, with a focus on East Asia, especially the Philippines and Japan. If you're new to the podcast, GeoTrek explores the world to bring you stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. We love you joining in on our audio and video podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and like this content so we can grow the channel and bring you great content related to extreme weather and natural disasters around the world. Well, without further introduction, let's jump into this podcast with Robert Spetta. Robert, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek Podcast.
Hey, thank you very much, Hal, for having me. I'm excited to be here. I like talking weather, tropics. I want to geek out with you a little bit.
Well, you know, when I think of you, I just know of your obsession for tropical weather. We're entering hurricane season. I mean, what are you thinking for this year?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is, you know, as of late May, and I cover a lot of global tropics. We haven't had a named storm in the Northern Hemisphere yet in 2025, which is a little weird because this is actually the latest start to a Northern Hemisphere tropical season since 1973.
Really? And that's pretty unusual.
Yeah, it is.
Western Pacific, usually something's going on by now, right?
I've covered storms on January 1st in the Western Pacific. So there's no real season start or end. But it's really interesting. Granted, in 1973, the West PAC did form up several major typhoons that year. So it's not a calibration of how bad the season will be. But I found that, you know, so far what the season's looking like is kind of interesting. But, you know, it is what it is. It only takes one, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, Robert, when I first met you, I was surprised. I was shocked to hear how much experience you have forecasting and living through typhoons in East Asia, the Western North Pacific. I mean, let's talk about that. Like, how long did you spend there in East Asia, Western North Pacific? Tell us about your experiences.
All right, sure. Yeah. So a quick background before I went to East Asia and Western Pacific. I actually, out of high school, I joined the Navy. They had a urographer's mate rating, which is basically a Navy weather guy. That's what we're called, you know. I spent some time in Mayport, got some experience there, Mayport in the northeastern Florida, so the Jacksonville area. And then I got stationed in 2009 aboard the USS Blue Ridge, which is the 7th Fleet Command, basically and making sure the entire Western Pacific ships don't sail into typhoons. And a lot of other stuff. You know, I was out there for the March 11th, the earthquake, tsunami, and subsequent radiational fallout. You know, I'm actually one of the only meteorologist, American meteorologist, that have forecasted and plotted radiation fallout in a real situation. But I mean, after that, you know, I got out of the Navy. I spent several years on TV at NHK World. That's out of Tokyo, Japan. So, TV broadcasting with them. And I came back in 2017, but since then, still operating and running my website. I fly out to the Western Pacific on occasion and just covering typhoons. So I've got about almost 15 years now of continuous covering of typhoons and other weather events in the West PAC.
That's tremendous. Okay, I have to drill down into this. So you're there with the U.S. Armed Forces forecasting typhoons in the Western North Pacific. Are you like on land? Are you on an aircraft carrier? Like, where are you when you're doing this?
That's a good question. That's actually, so I was aboard the USS Blue Ridge when I was out there, which is it's only one of two ships like it in the entire fleet of the U.S. Navy. They're called command ships. So basically, there's like one gun on it. And that's like just kind of a fail safe. So it's not a go blow stuff up type of ship. It had tons of satellites and, you know, this early the mid 2000s, the internet is sat. Satellite internet. It's just not available pretty much. So all these different satellite communications and stuff all over it. So we can give the kind of the real time updates on the fleet and directly to the admiral. But it's a, It's a special type of ship.
Yeah, it sounds like a weather, floating weather lab. Were you mostly like docked at port, or were you out in the open water, or did it depend?
I would say about 50-50. Okay. You'd be docked at port a lot of times. But the one thing, the cool thing about this ship, and this is just, if you got anybody listening here that wants to join the Navy, you try to get on this ship. It's the best one in the fleet because the 3-star admiral is on board. So we're not out to sea for too long. But the other good part about it, since it's not really a combat type ship, it's more of, sometimes it was kind of like the admiral's party boat. So it was a lot of public affairs. So we would pull into places like the Philippines, and the president of the Philippines would come on board. So it's like this high stake, not so much operational, but a party forecast. I would have to do a lot for the admiral and all these, you know, VIPs that would come on board and just kind of hang out. And he'd be like, okay, I'm going golfing tomorrow with like the president of Palau. If it rains, you are fired. You know, like, okay. That's one reason why I got out of the Navy. Very high stress forecast, you know.
Oh, that's fascinating, man. So it's kind of like you're there kind of like interfacing, interacting with the culture, but also like getting into this specific weather. And then typhoons are just like a different beast, right? I mean, they can be incredibly intense. And some of these seasons, they'll be like 20, 25, 30. I mean, like tons of named storms out there, right?
Yeah, you know, and I was just saying a second ago, it's there is no start or end to typhoon season either. There's just January 1st, I've covered storms. In February is the low point, but on average, there's typically one or two. And then you get into the latter part of the season and it ramps up. And yeah, you know, going, if there was an alphabet to go through, it'd go through every year. It's pretty much ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've even seen huge impacts in November, like Super Typhoon Haiyan Yolanda in the Philippines, right? I mean, it's like pretty much things have winded down here in the States and it's still going strong. I mean, it just seems like a ton of activity out there that can be year round, like you're saying.
Yeah. And, you know, even in the Philippines, they have a kind of a thing they call storms in December. They're called Grinch storms. Like every year they bring up, oh, it's a Grinch storm, means it's around Christmas. So like, so they occur so often that late in the season that there is kind of a nickname for those type of storms.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Okay, we're going to test here my limited, very, very limited knowledge of international typhoon forecasting. I know there's a Joint Typhoon Warning Center. Is that U.S. Navy as well? Is that based? And then I know there's also a focus on the Western Pacific or East Asia, but also the Northern Indian Ocean as well. I mean, how does this all look like internationally as far as the U.S. is involved in forecasting these things?
So when I look at the agencies in the Western Pacific and the Indian Ocean from a broadcasting standpoint, it's like I'm looking at formulas and different things coming in because there is so much complexity. So let's start off with JTWC. That is the U.S. military. But and JTWC covers basically the East Pac, the West Pac, and the Indian Ocean, but they primarily the Western Pacific and the Indian Ocean where military assets are. If you ever notice at a JTWC forecast, though, they never actually forecast conditions. So like the National Hurricane Center will say a 3 to 5 foot storm surge, and I expect winds like this at this spot. JTWC never does that because they are specifically military. So they want to know ships need to get out of the way pretty much, or bases needs to prepare, but they don't ever forecast exactly.
Is it stuff. More like intensity at the core and tracking and basically more of what's going to happen over open water?
Yeah. So they do focus on it. One thing the JTBC does do that I think is kind of nice, though. They do put out wind fields on their like kind of cone of air of how far 35, 40 knots, you know, or 35 knots and I believe 65 and then 120 extend out from the center. But it is very operational led. So you have to look at the other agencies like JMA, which is the official agency of the Western Pacific, you know, they do. I honestly think JTBC is better forecasting than JMA. There's like these pros and cons of both of them. But then you have PAGASA, which is another agency in the Western Pacific. And this each country has their own agencies.
PAGASA is Philippines and JMA is Japan, right?
Yeah. JMA is Japan, PAGASA the Philippines. But I bring up both of these agencies because they also name storms differently. So sometimes if you see a storm near the Philippines, you'll see it has two names. Yeah. Like, you mentioned Hayan earlier, also known as Yolanda in the Philippines. But then JTWC doesn't name storms, but they put a nomenclature on it. It's a hot mess.
Talking to other like weather enthusiasts and forecasters and storm chasers that have been there in East Asia, like Josh Morgerman, he said, man, places like Taiwan and the Philippines, like you go to certain places and they're just built like to take a cat four, like just they're building out of concrete and different things. Did you notice that at all in your time in East Asia, like just building differently or maybe in some ways better for hurricane/typhoon impacts?
Yes, 1,000%. I've heard somebody recently say, hey, it's some of these countries, you know, like the Philippines is a developing nation. I get it, but they build for these storms. One of the spots that is really built for it that I've noticed is in Okinawa. So southwestern Japan, they build for like Cat 4, Cat 5 winds. You know how like on the Gulf Coast, you're like, okay, my house will probably be good up to a Cat 2. If a 4 hits, whatever, you know, it is what it is. But they build like to the point you just mentioned Josh Morgerman. He has videos of like K cars. So they're like these small Japanese cars just getting launched, you know, and I've seen this damage where at the end of a road, there'll be like 5 cars piled up, but the infrastructure and the buildings they're not even like people just step outside, kind of brush stuff away and be like, we're good to go. And I mentioned the cars getting launched because the cars aren't built for that, but the buildings are just they're. I know in Okinawa, it's the law. If you build a new building, it has to be reinforced concrete. That's like the law, like steel bars. You can't go to like Home Depot and buy like a backyard shed. It's against the law because they know every year that thing's going to explode at some point due to a Cat 4 or Cat 5 pushing through.
I guess they're just getting so many hits by so many really strong typhoons that at some point it sounds like you're saying they're building from reinforced concrete. Mm-hmm. You're probably not seeing a lot of wood, right?
Yeah. And plus there's just not a lot of lumber around, you know, on places like that, but you don't really see it. It's everything is reinforced concrete on islands like that. And I mean, even other areas, not so much further north you go if you head to Tokyo, but it's really those southern islands. And even northern areas of the Philippines are like that too. Like there will be at least in every small town, a building that is just, it is a vault where everybody goes into. And it's just one of those things like you see a lot of small towns along the Gulf Coast or along on Florida that it's all wooden homes up there. Yeah, they might be stilted or lifted, but there's not a lot of just like those buildings that you're like, okay, this could get hit by a bomb and it'll be okay. In the Westpac, there are a lot of places that are like that. They're just built for it.
It sounds like you're saying like in certain areas, you'll see maybe every building is reinforced concrete. And then you were saying like Philippines, you might find a developing country where at least they have one central building where everyone can go, right? Even if everyone can't afford a reinforced concrete.
Yeah, exactly. Especially in a lot of those coastal areas. Now, the other thing that about like the Philippines and really the Western Pacific for that matter is that storm surge isn't so much of a big deal either. So you're really building for the winds, especially in Japan, Taiwan, across the coast of China. That's not always the case. I mean, Haiyan, Odette are clear examples of a pretty decent storm surge in parts of the Philippines, but these are usually localized in these bays and inlets. It's not more like if you think of the Gulf Coast, you get a storm surge and it's going to be along the entire coastline. That's not really the case out there. It's like these specific bays or inlets they're very predictable where the high storm surge will be. But for the most part, people are more worried about the winds there.
That's interesting. So let's talk about this with more of this wind impact. Sociologically, if you're in the Philippines, you're in Japan, these other places in East Asia, what's the response like? Like, will you see a mass evacuation or are people more hunkering down? I mean, what does it look like?
That's a really good question because this is one of the big cultural differences I've seen from living in Japan to coming back to the States is that there's no evacuation really to speak of. I'll start with Japan. Now, other countries, sometimes you'll get it in those low-lying kind of areas. People will go like a mile or two inland just to get out of a storm surge threat. But there's never really an evacuation for wind. But specifically in Japan, in a lot of those places, it's an island. So where are you going to evacuate to anyways? Like Okinawa, I was just mentioning, you know, that's not a very big island. It's relatively small. So the mentality is when the winds start picking up, you go inside, you hunker down. A lot of people just have a couple beers and wait for it to pass. That's kind of the way it's built, you know? In Tokyo, Tokyo is just breaks my mind because there will be days where it's like a straight up Cat 1 pushing through and the city doesn't stop. Like it just doesn't, it just doesn't stop. The trains, it'll stop when the trains start getting delayed. And then people are like, I can't get to work because 90% of the people take the train. But otherwise, it's like, if I can walk to work, the city doesn't stop. Everything's still going. There's no evacuation idea. It's just be smart, stay inside. If you're along the coast or some of these areas that really will get hit, people just kind of hunker down because where are you going to evacuate to? It's an island, right?
Yeah, you know, and you brought up a good point. If you're on an island, where are you going to evacuate to? But this comes up with massive metro areas too, right? Like I heard someone recently say, why did they not evacuate Houston during Hurricane Harvey? It's like, where are you going to put 7 million people? You know, like you just can't evacuate big cities. So that, but that's interesting. It sounds like Tokyo just keeps on going even in substantial wind and rain.
I've never seen Tokyo shut down. I was out there for, you know, almost a decade, never once. And we got hit by several good storms. Never once did the city stop. Some of those coastal towns will slow down a little bit. And what I mean by that, it's like, let's say the storm's going to hit sometime between 6 a.m. and 10 a.m. By lunchtime, they're like, all right, I got to get to work, back to work, got to do our things here. So it definitely is a different mentality. Probably, I think it's because they hit so often that it's to the point where it's like, if we shut down every time a good typhoon came through, what are we going to, we're never going to be working.
Robert, I want to ask you too, like Japan gets a lot of typhoons, but then when you look back through their disaster history, you see these absolutely catastrophic earthquakes and tsunamis. At some point, does that kind of change the mentality that, like, relatively speaking, a typhoon isn't that bad because it's not like the 9.1 earthquake with tremendous tsunami? I mean, how does that play out? Because they have really multiple extreme hazards there.
Yeah, right. And I never really thought of it that way, but you're like, in a country that has so many different types of disasters, it's like when you're talking about a typhoon, yeah, it's going to be windy, but as long as I'm inside and I'm safe, I'm okay. You know, and I guess to the same sense of earthquakes, you know, many times, like the whole world will start shaking. And I got to the point by the time I left where I was just like, okay, is this going to be it? Is this really going to like, oh, okay. It was only a little bit of a wobble. A couple things fell off the shelf. I'm going about my day. You know, it had to be a really good shaker for people to be spooked with earthquakes. Yeah. So I get that fatigue and kind of with it. Like you've seen it all.
It's this concept of when you get anything at a high frequency, right? You can go to the Great Lakes where it'll snow 22 days in a row. Kids aren't, you're not canceling school. I mean, the kids would stay home 2/3 of the winter, right? So at some point, it's just like, okay, you're seeing this stuff all the time. Life has to go on, right?
Yeah. And you know, that's, goes back to the typhoon thing. And this is the same problem I think we have for some people that may have been hit by, I guess it's kind of the opposite problem. Some parts of Florida actually, where they haven't been hit by a storm in a long time. So a lot of people aren't really taking it serious. In places like the Philippines, they get hit by so many typhoons that there is, I have to differentiate between like a Cat 1, Cat 2 typhoon a lot of times with people to when they get up to that super typhoon category, which is a high-end Cat 4, Cat 5, and be like, you got to take this serious. I know you get the storms a lot, but these ones are different. And so it's tough to overcome that fatigue sometimes and make sure people are taking it serious.
I see what you mean. If you're communicating with an audience that's been through maybe dozens of typhoons, how do you communicate about that one, that super typhoon Haiyan / Yolanda, that's going to be really different in a place like Tacloban, right? And see a massive wind and massive surge. Like that's probably a challenge to communicate, right?
Yeah. And to that note, for places like Tacloban that did get hit by that specific storm, that city, I feel like, is the most prepared now because they have been hit by that level of storm. But yeah, it is tough for other areas outside of just that specific city to just explain to them, hey, the storm's going to be next level. You want to at least get away from the coast. I know you've been through them, but this this one will actually be bringing a significant storm surge. Because, you know, the even the warning system in some of those countries is still evolving, and people are like Haiyan, you bring up a lot of times. A lot of people, during that storm didn't really know what the term storm surge really meant either.
Yeah.
It was a tsunami they got, but storm surge wasn't. So it is a really hard communications in that area.
Well, and like you said, you know, I actually worked with Pagasa to build the first storm surge database for the Philippines. And just like you said, we don't see these really broad, widespread storm surges where hundreds of miles or kilometers are getting it all the time. They're very isolated in a different bay or different inlet. So you could experience 20 typhoons and never really get a big surge until typhoon number 21, right? Mm. Makes it difficult to, when it's that isolated and that localized, I think there's a challenge in communication for sure.
But I mean, they do need more of those storm surge modeling. So that's fantastic. You're working with them because these are the type of things that I think will save lives. Isn't some like in the United States, we are so spoiled with, and I say spoiled, it's a good spoiled. It's like, if you're going to give me cake and I want to eat the cake, I like cake. All right. So in the United States, we got all of the cake and we're spoiled with our storm surge modeling, our recon, our just different tools that the National Hurricane Center and commercial enterprises have to getting tropical forecasting for us in places like the Philippines where, you know, the forecasters there, they are doing a heck of a job given the fact that, especially in the Philippines, Pagasa, I've been to their headquarters a few times. They do an amazing job given the tools that they have available to them. So whenever somebody comes in and helps out with storm surge modeling, JMA even has donated radar to them. It helps out because, boy, they get hit by so many storms that and given the resources they have available, it's incredible that more people don't get impacted and deaths and things like that with some of these major typhoons there.
It sounds like you're saying like Western North Atlantic, the Atlantic Basin, the U.S., we have more resources. I know, for example, we have the hurricane hunters that fly into hurricanes to calibrate and improve the models. Is there anything like that in the Western North Pacific where any Air Force is flying into hurricanes or typhoons?
No, it's just no, it's not. There is the occasional recon from a private enterprise. Like there was a college out of Okinawa was flying in for a while. Taiwan flies some stuff like NOAA around the edges. But usually they keep this information close to their chest. They don't really release it to the public for modeling. Like the NOAA hunters, they go out and that data is instantly put into models. Like they don't do that. So we basically just depend on Dvorak analysis, which is an old analysis. I mean, that's like 30, 40 years old of analyzing the storm. And that's why sometimes like this is interesting. So one of the last times the C-130s, the American Hurricane Hunters was flying into a typhoon in the Western Pacific was Typhoon Megi. I believe it was 2011. Now it was out here and it was doing some, studying. It was just doing research in the Philippine Sea. It picked up a pressure, and I have to double check this, but I think it was one of the lowest ever recorded in a typhoon in this one specific storm that they were flying into. I think it was down to 890 HPA. It was somewhere around there. It was an absolutely ridiculously low pressure. And it was like they flew into just one of these storms, which was kind of a run-of-the-mill super typhoon in the Westpac in the last 20 years. And they got this record crazy low pressure out of it. It's like if we had recon like they have in the United States, I'm sure we would have had 870, maybe because tip was 870 and that had a recon flying into it in the 70s. You imagine what some of these storms would have?
It makes you wonder. I mean, if they were flying into most of these, they'd probably be smashing records all the time, right? With just these ridiculously low pressures. Robert, we're at that point of the podcast where we ask every guest the question of weathered wisdom. So what is a weather event that stands out to you that influenced you professionally or personally, something that you will never forget you observed with the weather? What's your weathered wisdom?
Oh, man. I think number one for me, this one is actually it's a geology / weather. And it's one of the ones that really just got me into wanting to go outside. I mean, I've been through the typhoons, the storms and everything, but it was when I was sitting at the base of an active volcano, Sakurajima, and it was right at sunrise. sunrise, this thing explodes. And that's the geology part of it, the volcanology. It goes up, gorgeous sunrise, ashes everywhere. But then it started kicking lightning out of it at the same time, which,
Jesus, lightning coming out of the ash cloud on an active volcano.
Yes. Yeah, it was the most just, so you see the shock wave, there's lightning flying out of it. And I'm like, I liked it. That's when I went from kind of, this was after I was out of the Navy, and I was kind of in the broadcasting. I want to be, and that's where I was like, you know, I like doing the TV side of things, but I really want to be out in the field because this is just amazing. So that was
ridiculous. Yeah, I can't imagine even seeing that.
Oh, it was absolutely amazing. It was one of those like, all right, done.
And you're like, dude, I just see that, you know? And that's the thing too. I mean, I've never seen anything quite like that, but there is this thing when you travel the world and you go into extreme weather, Mother Nature always has a way to surprise you, right?
Oh, and I mean, it's anything, just getting outside of your box and going somewhere else. And that's one reason I love working in East Asia, Western Pacific, because even if I ever went on like a chase or I went to like somewhere to just kind of document some weather and there was nothing there, I'm still in like an exotic country having a good time. That's the best part about it there.
Yeah, absolutely. You're going to have an adventure any way you cut it. Hey, so Robert, you made your way back to the States and you're based, I think, in the Jacksonville, Florida area. So do you like mostly now still forecast for East Asia? Do you forecast for the U.S.? I mean, how does this work? Like, where are you mostly forecasting now?
So I kind of a different world, you know. My main job is at First Coast News out of Jacksonville, Florida. I do TV weather as well as, you know, behind the scenes out in this field. I kind of a jack of all trades with that, but it's basically forecasting the weather and along the First Coast, Northeast Florida, Southeast Georgia. I moonlight still at my website, westernpacificweather.com, Westpac Weather on YouTube, where I do a lot of typhoon coverage. I think at some point I probably would have stepped back and stopped doing it, but there's an audience for it. There's an audience for English-based weather forecasting in East Asia, because that's one reason why I started doing it, is because I was out there and I was looking for information. I couldn't find anything. So I'm like, okay. So there's an audience for it. People still tune in every time. So I still moonlight and do that as well. So kind of two different worlds, tracking hurricanes here and still watching that.
Robert, so let's talk about your audience. Like, this is really interesting. We've never had anyone on the podcast that has this expertise in Western North Pacific typhoons. I mean, tell us about your audience. Is it mostly East Asia media? Do you have people in the business sectors? Like, I know there's obviously tons of international commerce. These typhoons affect shipping. I mean, who's interested in this kind of information, especially from an English-speaking audience?
You know, a lot of first off, most of my audience does come out of the Philippines, because it may not be the official language of the Philippines, but a lot of people speak English in the Philippines, so a lot of people watch from there. Also, military is one of a big group of my audience. U.S. military in Japan, and also, you know, all across Southeast Asia, but a lot of them just who are, especially in Okinawa, if there's a typhoon coming, they want to kind of get that feel of a local weather forecast for them, so people tune in with that. I do get some operational people, like farmers that like to jump in, especially with the monsoon season. There's somebody I'm helping out right now who's actually sailing from the Marshall Islands to the Ogasawara Islands. So they're just cutting right across the Western Pacific, and they keep on, they're giving me some updates. I'm giving them some sailing forecasts, things like that.
Let's bring it back stateside. Northeast Florida to me is really fascinating, as well as coastal Georgia. We see, if you go back deep enough in history, some really bad things have happened. But, you know, in general, the last several decades, pretty quiet, not completely. I mean, we saw some flooding, like even surprising flooding, like in Irma in 2017. But what is the hurricane culture like? I mean, when you forecast and when you engage with people, how engaged are people? How complacent are they? What does the culture look like to you as you're forecasting there in Northeast Florida and coastal Georgia?
Well, you mentioned Irma, and in the last few years, it feels like the Jacksonville area specifically has been brushed by a bunch of storms, but not really hit by a bunch of storms. And what I mean by that is, like, last year, for example, we had Milton and Helene. Well, so Helene passed west of Jacksonville, really impacted Lake City. Milton passed south of Jacksonville, really impacted, like, Daytona area. So Jacksonville hasn't been hit by a Cat 1 sustained wind actually in the city since Dora in 1964. So there's been so many brushes that I get the feeling like people feel like in the last few years they've been through it. And they have. They've been through some good tropical storms. We've had Irma was a good tropical storm conditions, at least in Jacksonville, where there was some decent flooding. But there hasn't been a full-on hurricane. So I get the feeling like sometimes people think that was a hurricane, but it just wasn't that quite yet. So it feels like people are kind of prepared, but they're not mentally to how bad it can actually get in those bigger storms.
It sounds like you're saying there have been a lot of brushes. It's gotten people's attention and they've been on the fringe. But like, would you say if you actually had, say, sustained Cat 1 winds, 85 miles an hour in the city of Jacksonville, this would shock a lot of people?
Yes, 1,000%.
And do you think a lot of those people would say, oh, I've been through a whole bunch of Cat 1s until they actually see sustained Cat 1 winds? Would you say that's probably likely?
I mean, because we see this a lot, is people tend to overestimate winds. Yeah. So I'll have people like, it's like very obviously 30, 40 mile per hour winds, like a tree limb falls down. And they're like, it was like 50 to 80 miles. Like, no, it's a different level once you get up to that hurricane intensity. So I think a lot of people would be shocked, especially by the winds. If you get up that high and it's sustained, I think it's going to catch people off guard since we've been brushed by so many storms where max gusts were 40, 50 miles per hour. And they start to think that's a hurricane.
Yeah, you know, Alan Seals, famous meteorologist out of Mobile, Alabama, he used to always stress to people when they say this is a Cat 2 hurricane, they just mean at some geographic location in the storm, the max winds are Cat 2. But most of the people impacted by the storm are not seeing those max winds. You know, they're on the fringe, they're seeing something much less. And so it's important maybe to realize what we've been through compared to what could happen, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's just part of the communication to make sure everybody's kind of informed of that. And then on storm surge too, because in Jacksonville, there is the threat of storm surge, not only on the coast, but inland. So the city sits right on the St. John's River, but you almost get a Seiche type of event when the winds are coming in straight from the south and kind of blowing the water up towards the city. So, and that's what happened with Irma. And again, with, I believe Ian, is you kind of had that southerly wind kind of blowing the water up. So, it's a multiple impacts, and hopefully we don't ever get a direct hit because it's been so long. I think the other one more thing about Jacksonville that does worry me, and it's the same problem with the entire state of Florida, is so many people are moving here and that there are a lot of buildings and homes now in places that were not there 10, 20 years ago. So they haven't been tested yet.
And a population probably that's not real familiar with hurricanes, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we do these hurricane specials every year, as every TV market on the start of hurricane season, June 1st, we go through and kind of talk stories and explain to people about, you know, what a hurricane is. And at some point, I always think to myself, do they not know this yet? And then it's like, well, not really, because there's so many people moving in that, and they're moving from places like me. I was born outside of Buffalo. You know, if you put 12-year-old me here in Florida, I'd be like, the hurricane's windy. I don't know, you know, so I get it.
Yeah, that's such a good point about transplants and the knowledge that they're bringing in or lack of knowledge with hurricanes. Robert, I wish we could double or triple our time. It's so dynamic talking to you, your insights, your energy. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time, but as we land the plane here, what's one last take-home message you'd like to share with our audience just about how to really think about hurricanes, typhoons, just the threat of tropical weather?
Yeah, oh, that's a good question. You know, I guess just always take it serious, you know, and that's not to say like the panic or anything, but it only takes one storm. And even if you think you've been through it or you're kind of feel like you're ready, just make sure you double check, make sure you're taking every storm serious. Cause I've seen not only here in the States, but around the world, people that may not, and it has some serious outcomes. So always take every storm serious because it only takes one to really impact you.
Yeah, that's a good point, that complacency. Today, I was just talking to a group here in coastal Texas, and we always look at the seasonal forecasting, how many named storms. And we were talking today, back in 1983, there were only 4 named storms, but one of them was a Cat 3 that hit our community here in Texas. So again, if a Cat 3 hits your community, for you, it was a bad year, right? Even if there weren't that many in the basin.
Exactly. What was it? Andrew was an A-name storm in, what, September, was it?
So, last week of August or so. Oh, so yeah, that's very late in the season, you know, for the A storm. Robert, how can our audience find you? I mean, how can people find you if they want to look you up, if they have questions for you, if they want to interact?
Yeah, I'm on social medias. Just look up Robert Spetta and any of the different social medias, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all of that. If you want to watch my YouTube stuff with East Asia and typhoons, look up Western Pacific Weather or Westpac Weather, and I post daily updates there as well.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for your insights. Maybe this will be the year where there are no named storms.
Right? My severe thunderstorm warning is going on.
There you go. That means our podcast is over. No, totally. I know you're plugged in, man. Severe weather, tropical weather.
Right? Stuff is popping. Gotta get the radar up.
So much appreciate you coming on the podcast before the apocalypse hit here. But always a great time with you. We're going to definitely, I'll be watching your coverage, as will a lot of our audience this year, as we look at your coverage in the States and over in the Western North Pacific as well.
Well, thank you very much, Hal, for having me. I appreciate you.
Robert, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast. This was a fast-paced episode. Robert has a lot of energy, if you've noticed, so we covered a lot of ground. It was very dynamic. Three main points stand out to me in this podcast. Number one, how we build matters. We've covered this before on the podcast, but Robert was talking about building practices in East Asia, especially in places like Okinawa, Japan, that they build so well for Category 4 typhoons. They're withstanding these strong storms all the time. Robert mentioned that most of these structures are built with reinforced concrete. And, you know, we've talked about this in East Asia. We've talked about this in the Caribbean. Josh Morgerman was on the podcast. He talked about the amazing building practices in places like the Bahamas. We see a lot of these island areas, a lot of these places that are tropical islands that get a lot of hurricanes, get a lot of typhoons. They're really building for these events, withstanding them. Robert even mentioned you can go into Tokyo when they're getting hit by a typhoon and more or less things are still carrying on. It's amazing to look at the cultural differences, and it's a reminder that how we build matters and can really have an impact on how resilient we are to hurricanes, typhoons, or really any natural disaster that threatens our communities. Number two, I thought it was amazing by how global and connected our world is. I mean, we've had a lot of international guests. We've covered international topics, but I thought it was really interesting to see how in this age of technology, we have an amazing forecaster in Northeast Florida that's doing accurate weather forecasts for East Asia, half of a world away. I mean, just it reminds us how connected the world is. We talk a lot about that a lot on the podcast. And Robert's just another person here that's doing a lot of amazing international work from a different part of the world. Just really cool to see that in action. And then number three, I thought it was really interesting to bring these topics back home to the U.S. and talk about Robert's perspective in northeastern Florida and coastal Georgia. He mentioned that this area of the country has been very lucky. They've had a lot of brushes and scrapes. They've been on the edge a lot of hurricanes, but they've not really had a direct hit since Hurricane Dora in 1964. And he mentioned how a lot of folks say in Jacksonville area, Jack's Beach, all the way up into Georgia, they may think that they're very familiar with hurricanes. They may think they've gone through a dozen or more hurricanes, but really, they haven't really been in the core of one for a long time. And he really mentioned that he thinks a lot of people will be surprised one day when they get sustained, say, Cat 1 or 2 winds. A lot of folks are going to say, okay, this is very different than what I've experienced before. So just a good reminder, even if you've been impacted by named storms, you've been on the fringe of a hurricane or you've been through a tropical storm, that's not the same as actually experiencing sustained hurricane force winds. Those winds are gusty and really damaging and destructive. And that's why we say we never call it just a Cat 1. When you actually go through hurricane force winds, you're like, wow, this is crazy. I want to hunker down and not take these storms for granted moving forward. So great insights from Robert. We covered a lot of ground on this podcast, all the way from Georgia and Northeast Florida to East Asia and places like Japan and the Philippines. Robert, thanks so much again for joining us on the podcast. And thank you again to our faithful listeners. Your support has made the GeoTrek podcast a top 5 podcast on the topic of natural disasters. So keep supporting the channel. We really encourage people to subscribe, follow, and like our content online. And you can even comment and interact with our videos and different content we're putting out there.
Your support, your following, your subscriptions, your interaction keep this channel more interactive, keep it engaged, and it enables us to create a lot more content moving forward. Thanks again for your support of the GeoTrek podcast. Thanks for joining us, Robert, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.